Members, I call the Environment and Natural Resources, Finance and Policy Committee to order. We have a lot to do today, so I'm going to be going through a few things. First, I will ask for a motion. Representative Burkle, have you looked at the minutes from February 25th?
I have reviewed the minutes from February 25th, and I'd move them.
Thank you, Representative Burkle. Representative Burkle moves the minutes from February 25th, 2025. All those in favor of passing the minutes, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. So we have three bills on the agenda today, and we're going to try to get through all of them. One dealing with data centers, another with foraging. Representative Schultz is working on that, and another with trespass laws, Representative Gilman. We have testifiers coming and wanting to participate today from all over the state. So we've notified each of those that have requested to testify that they have 2 minutes. I'm going to do the best I can to keep us on track so that everybody has that opportunity. And we need to get through, obviously, this agenda today in a timely fashion to accommodate all those folks. And so I will ask everybody to be extremely concise. And I'll give you a little warning as we're getting close to that 2 minute mark. But otherwise, just please be ready to wrap things up. Those of you that are testifying again at that 2 minute point. Representative Meckland, if you would like to come to the table. Representative Meckland, welcome to the committee. And since you are not a member of the committee, I will make the motion to move House File 28 to be recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. I understand there's going to be some discussion today on an amendment. So I will move the A4 to get the amendment in the shape that the bill author wants, but there's going to be some discussion to that. So to the amendment, Representative Meckland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So correct, the A4 amendment is a global agreement between the EQB, the PUC, and the MPCA. So in short, I do have Catherine Neuscher here, and she's from the EQB, so she could, she's going to join me here, and she can explain the really weedy parts of this. However, at the end of the day, here's what the alternative urban area-wide review process was part of some of the catches we had when we were in energy. What this does, it amends the language based on the suggestions from the EQB, the language now states that the local government can complete the AURA process, issues a final environmental review, documents and mitigation plans, environmental review for the approved activities is complete, and final permits and construction can begin for the approved developments. This means that when the city completes an AURA, the residential, commercial, light, industrial, and warehouse uses, like that of a data center, can move ahead even if the other state agencies are still doing their process, like the PUC or the MPCA. Need to conduct additional environmental review, on-site backup emergency generation for other infrastructure that will also be constructed along with the approved developments. So that is kind of the nutshell of what this all does. And if you would care to explain the really weedy parts.
Catherine, if you would like to introduce yourself for the record, and then I can use your formal title as well, that'd be great.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Meckman. My name is Catherine Neuscher. I'm the Executive Director of the Environmental Quality Board.
So. Thank you for that. And go ahead, and if you would help us to get through this amendment, that'd be great.
Sure, Mr. Chair, I can explain it a little bit. So the alternative urban area-wide review process is a substitute kind of environmental review that's designed for local governments to use for really classic kind of local government planning and development scenarios. So it's allowed to be used for residential, commercial, warehousing, and light industrial projects. It can't be used for industrial projects that trigger other kinds of mandatory categories within Minnesota's environmental review rules. So whether those be power plants, paper plants, any of the other items. And so really, you know, the first version of this bill we thought was drafted a little too broadly, and we worked with the author to bring it more in line with the current process and the current rules around the alternative area-wide review process. And it just provides a little bit of additional clarification. So really what it's meant to do is say the projects that are covered under an AUAR and they're reviewed, when that review is complete, that review is complete. And then the governmental permits and approvals can move ahead for those projects that are covered in the alternative area urban wide, the AUAR, as we call it. And then you also don't need to re-review any of those projects should you also then have to look through a separate process in any industrial projects in the area. And so we're satisfied after working with the author that this language better aligns with the current process and the current rules, and that because of those changes, we would no longer have to amend the rules for the alternative urban area-wide review process, which would get rid of the fiscal note for this bill from EQB.
Director Neuschler?
Neuschler.
Thank you for that. Members, do you have any questions on the amendment? Lead Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the way I heard you explain it is that once they have the initial approval from the local unit of government, they can start construction, even though that there may not be approval in hand for the other permits, whether they're from the MPCA or DNR or any of those other places?
Director.
Chair, Representative, yes, it would be for the projects that were covered under the alternative area urban-wide review, the AUAR process. And again, that's limited to the residential, commercial, warehousing, and light industrial projects. So generally, it's usually kind of the buildings and the permits that would be associated with building the buildings.
Any further questions?
Yes, Chair Heinzman, thank you. That feels a little different than when we have other permitting processes that go through the MPCA. I know that there's been issues where construction projects have not been able to go ahead because we're still waiting on permit approval from the MPCA for air permits, water permits, et cetera. So what is unique that allows that to happen here and not in the other processes?
Director.
And how do you keep it from, how do you keep it from spreading out so that they can do it in any other project?
Sure.
Director.
Yeah, Chair, Representative Fisher, I mean, I think, right, the environmental review always comes before the permit process and needs to be complete before the permits are issued. And again, what this is saying is that those development projects that are contained within the AUAR, when it is finished, those can go forward. So if there's an industrial project that triggers environmental review, if that environmental review is needed, it has to be complete for that industrial project before the permits for that industrial project can go ahead. So it's really just trying to be clear that there is a separation between the two, and we think that's consistent with the way Minnesota Rule 44-10-36-10 reads at the moment.
Members, any more to the A4? I'll just quickly mention we typically try to get the bill in the shape that the author would like so that we can debate it thoroughly. But if there is any more, I'm happy to. All right. Any more to the amendment?
No, Mr. Chair. I think we've established what exactly the amendment does.
All right. Members, all those in favor of passing the A4, please signify by saying aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Representative Mecklund, the bill is in the shape that you would like it. Was there any more that we wanted to discuss quickly at this point now that we have Director Neuschler here, or we can hold that till the end?
Well, to be the purview of which the Environmental Department or Committee has over this is really just limited to the amendment language, really, as well as lines 3.23 to 3.26, simply the numbers at the end change, and it goes to 7007.0250. So that is the area of which the purview for this committee lies as to what is all in this bill. But basically, the whole context of this is the fact that they're looking for backup generation. It's a very necessary thing within data centers. The Energy Committee toured a data center last Friday down in Chaska. It was a U.S. Bank's data center. They did a really good job of explaining to both Chair Acom and as well as myself and our other members that were there why it is so necessary and the essential need that they can never lose power. And it's all about the technology and the data flow. And that's really where it comes down to. So if there's if we can either, if anybody has any more questions for the director, or we can move into testifiers. Mr. Chair.
Sure, Representative Mecklenburg. We can go ahead and bring in some testifiers. I believe the mayor of Becker is up first on my list. So welcome, Mr. Mayor, and please introduce yourself for the record. Again, we're trying to keep things tight, so if you see me starting to do this, you have about 30 seconds. Go ahead.
Perfect. Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Mark Kobinger, and I'm the mayor of the city of Becker. I thank the committee for the opportunity to speak to you today in support of House File 28, which will provide the certainty of the rules and requirements that data center companies need to develop in Minnesota, as well for the communities they reside in. Allow me to tell you a little bit about Becker. We were a city of about 200 residents when NSP began construction of Sherco, and now we're home to 5,000. Our leaders have a long history of supporting industrial development that is necessary for society to function, helps the economy, and also protects our environment. In Becker, we value parkland, the great outdoors, and the health of the two rivers that border our city, the Elk and the Mississippi. When the Sherco retirement was announced, the city immediately began working with Xcel Energy to attract new businesses to replace the lost jobs and tax base, and data centers became central to this effort. House File 28 supports local zoning control for those communities that have gone through the rigorous alternative urban area-wide review process, and our city administrator will talk more about AUARs in his testimony. But to require businesses to redo requirements for development that have already been completed seems to me to be patently unfair and will jeopardize development throughout Minnesota. Data centers provide an absolutely necessary service for daily life, and like all types of businesses, they prudently plan to address any business interruption, in this case via standby generation. I don't see the sense to obligate a business to meet the same requirements of a power plant when data centers will only produce power for themselves in less than 1.5% of the time as a power plant. This bill has statewide implications, and while Becker is a model city for establishing and building relationships with forward-thinking, environmentally conscious businesses, we want to continue to do that. I appreciate Representative Mecklen for authoring House File 28, and I respectfully urge the committee's support. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Next up, we have the Becker City Administrator, Mr. Lerund. Please introduce yourself for the record. Same drill as before, 2 minutes.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Greg Lerund. I'm the Becker City Administrator. I thank you for the opportunity to come here today and provide testimony in support of House File 28. As Mayor Kobinger said, this will provide clarity and certainty of the rules and requirements data center developments need wherever in the state they are located. One aspect of the bill that is critical is it provides support to the Alternative Urban Area-Wide Reviews, or AUAR. It is important to understand what an AUR is and why this bill is impactful to the development process. The AUAR is not a development shortcut. An AUAR is a rigorous statutory environmental review planning tool that local governments can use as an alternative to an environmental impact statement. Rather than looking at the impacts of one specific development, the AUAR analyzes cumulative impacts to the environment on development scenarios over a defined area that is developed in response to the requirements of an EAW. AURs are required by statute to provide a level of urban impact analysis comparable to an EIS. It involves state agency input and public comment throughout the process. When an AUAR doesn't examine a particular impact, that evaluation process then moves to the appropriate state agencies for approval and permitting. But House File 28 prevents a duplicative effort where the AUAR has already examined the impact. One of the qualities that attracted Amazon and Microsoft to purchase property in Becker is the proximity of clean energy, the Sherco solar fields. These companies are significant consumers of energy, but they have told us they prefer that the source is clean and sustainable. Because the energy is so central to their business function, they must plan for power substitute to maintain business continuity when grid power is not available. The generators are needed to maintain that continuity, and is critical to all of the businesses and individuals who rely and utilize their service, which is all of us. And if they don't function, there are potentially significant disruptions. In this case, the generators they are proposing to use are the most environmentally friendly ones available. Except for monthly testing, the only time they will operate is when the power grid is down, and that is a time when we will need their services. The city appreciates Representative Makeland authoring House File 28 to provide clarity to some of these issues, and we urge committee approval.
Thank you for your testimony. Next is Superintendent of Becker Public School District. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Jeremy Schmidt, and I am the Superintendent of Becker Public Schools. I'm speaking today on behalf of the school district and the greater Becker community, advocating for the passage of House File 28. House File 28 promotes opportunities for expansion of data centers in Minnesota, particularly communities like Becker, where energy transition has already had a significant economic impact. As many of you know, and as we've heard earlier, Sherco Power Plant, having been part of our economic cornerstone of our community, contributing not only to local employment, but also providing a substantial portion of our school district's tax base. With Sherco's closure and planned decommissioning, we anticipate losing over 40% of our commercial tax base, which is approximately $5 million of our $12 million. This loss could force difficult choices, increasing class sizes and reducing support services, as well as scaling back educational programs, all of which directly impact the academic success and well-being of our students. House File 28 offers practical and forward-thinking solutions to these challenges, supporting data centers to Becker. These data centers provide an opportunity to backfill the tax revenue gap, create new high-paying jobs, and encourage infrastructure investment. Additionally, they align with Minnesota's clean energy goals. Becker is currently home to the largest solar farm, I believe, in Minnesota, a testament to our community's drive and our state's commitment to providing clean energy opportunities. It's extremely likely that data centers are going to be built mostly in Minnesota, and ensuring they are located on ideal sites like Becker is crucial. Our community offers unique advantages with this infrastructure, workforce readiness, and a proven commitment to renewable energy. By welcoming these investments, we can provide a lifeline to our school district and local economy, providing educational quality and stability as we transition to a new energy future. As superintendent, my priority is to ensure students have resources they need to succeed. This bill will help Becker continue providing these educational opportunities for our students and stabilize our economy as we move toward a new energy future. Supporting House File 28 is not about just economic growth. It's about preserving opportunities for our children and ensuring that our community remains strong and vibrant. I want to thank Representative Mecklen for authoring this bill and ask for support of House File 28. It presents a critical opportunity for economic stability and growth for Becker and the surrounding communities. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Next, from IBEW State Council, Mr. Johnson. Mr. Johnson, if you could introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony, that'd be great.
Chair Heintzman, members of the committee, my name's Joel Johnson, and I'm here on behalf of the IBEW State Council, which represents over 15,000 electrical workers from around the state, including hundreds who are already working in data centers being built in Minnesota, and thousands more who will get to work if we properly align state policy and taxes to encourage their siting in Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of H File 28. Thank you, Representative Mecklen, for introducing and carrying this bill. We believe if we're fully to take advantage of the benefits of hyperscale data centers, and there are benefits, we need to make sure that state laws and taxes are aligned to encourage their construction here. Having them built and operated in Minnesota means literally thousands of jobs for IBEW members when the facilities are being built, and hundreds of permanent jobs when the centers are operational. These are really good jobs. They allow our members to go home at night and have dinner with their family. And the promise of three or four years of work is really, really a benefit to our members. We also have increased property taxes to schools and local governments. The 24/7 electrical demand helps make more efficient use of our grid, particularly intermittent resources like wind and solar, and thousands of hours of work for other trades during construction, maintenance, and upgrades. Again, we urge you to support this bill. This means a lot of work for our members, and I'm available to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Joe Parkhurst, Native Sun Community Power Development. Thank you, Joe. And if you could introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Yes. Hi. My name is Joe Parkhurst. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Joe Parkhurst, and I work with the field of energy infrastructure and business development. I appreciate the opportunity to provide insight today on HF 28 and discuss ways Minnesota can strengthen its position as a leader in energy reliability and economic growth. HF 28 is designed to improve energy redundancy for data centers by streamlining the approval process for emergency backup generators. Reliable backup power is essential for these facilities, but as currently written, HF 28 focuses primarily on fossil fuel-based solutions, such as diesel generators, without accounting for other proven market-ready alternatives that offer the same reliability and efficiency. Across the country, states with large data center footprints, such as Washington, have experienced energy constraints due to limited redundancy options. Minnesota has opportunity to take a forward-looking approach by ensuring that a range of solutions, including modern energy storage, are available to businesses operating in the state. Backup energy should be flexible and adaptable to industry needs. Battery energy storage systems, or BESS, are already being deployed at large scales across the country, demonstrating that they can match or exceed the reliability of diesel generators. Projects like the 600-milliwatt Morro Bay system in California or Ørsted's 11-mile solar center in Arizona show that the battery storage is commercially viable and scalable for data center operations. By ensuring that HF 28 considers BESS as a permitted emergency backup option, Minnesota could support energy innovation, encourage business investment, and provide companies with greater flexibility in choosing the best energy solutions for their operations. This would create a balanced approach to energy security while also positioning Minnesota for growth in advanced energy manufacturing and deployment. I encourage the committee to consider the full range of backup energy solutions available as you evaluate HF 28, ensuring that businesses have the option to utilize battery energy storage systems alongside traditional generators would provide long-term benefits in energy reliability, economic opportunity, and infrastructure development. Minnesota has a chance to lead the energy innovation while also supporting industries that rely on dependable power. Thank you for your time and for considering how HF 28 can provide businesses with the best possible options to secure their operations.
Thank you. Sarah Wolf. Next is Sarah Wolf, Interfaith Power and Light. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Heinzman and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Wolf, and I'm the Strategic Policy Director with Minnesota Interfaith Power and Light. We are an organization made up of over 400 faith communities across the state of Minnesota who are committed to a clean and just, equitable energy future. I'd like to thank this committee for the opportunity to consider House File 28 and the issues data centers pose for our communities. House File 28 is proposed to exempt emergency backup power systems from requiring a certificate of need. One of the things that most concerns us about this proposal is the way it would eliminate the opportunity for communities and our regulatory agencies to explore alternatives to the proposal that would better serve the surrounding neighbors. Amazon has proposed to build 250 diesel generators to provide backup power. Those generators have climate impacts. They have air pollution impacts, spewing particulate matter, nitrogen oxides, and other toxic and carcinogenic contaminants. And this really is not necessary in the year 2025. Investing in diesel generators misses an important opportunity to take advantage of other options like renewables paired with battery storage. Instead of building backup generators based on diesel, Amazon Data Services could support the build out of solar and battery storage in the communities in which they are building, benefiting those communities, saving them money, saving them tax dollars, instead of polluting the air. These are the kinds of plans that a healthy future requires. And this is the discussion that is missed if huge quantities of backup generators are allowed without any evaluation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was perfect. Really appreciate that. Next, Sierra Club North Star Chapter, Peter. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Peter Wiginius, Legislative Director for Sierra Club North Star Chapter, one of the 23 organizations signing a letter opposed to this bill. Why are we grappling with this issue? Because Minnesota provides a data center tax credit, an automatic, uncapped corporate giveaway that has already cost Minnesota taxpayers over $350 million. Originally estimated at less than $5 million, the program has ballooned to over $110 million a year. As the data centers proliferate, this will get worse unless the legislature acts. And who are we subsidizing? Not Minnesotans struggling to afford their lives, but some of the wealthiest corporations in the world, Amazon, Google, Microsoft, oligarchs with invitations to inaugurations. They don't need our tax dollars to make their profits even higher. As described in our letter, these centers are not just subsidy hogs hurting our budget and energy hogs hurting our grid. They're also water hogs, causing both water pollution and water depletion. So in addition to giving them our money, we could give them our water as well. A recent report from Berkeley Labs estimates that by 2028, hyperscale data centers will consume between 15 and 31 billion gallons of water annually. Proponents argue these facilities are going to go somewhere, so we should bring them to Minnesota because we're so good at environmental protections. Nonsense. Please visit peoplenotpolluters.com before assuming this administration can be relied upon to protect us from corporate polluters. Peoplenotpolluters.com, a project of 19 environmental organizations, documents 12 examples of polluter capture of state agencies. It includes examples where the courts or federal agencies had to step in when the Walz administration failed to protect Minnesotans and our environment. But we don't have a federal backstop anymore. Minnesotans are on our own now. If the legislature doesn't step up and insist that Minnesotans are protected, then Minnesotans won't be protected. The path to Minnesota exceptionalism is not to assume it and brag about it like inherited wealth, but rather to do the work and earn it. The legislature needs to develop comprehensive legislation to protect Minnesotans from multiple risks of data centers, and the bills that are under consideration move in exactly the wrong direction. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony today. Next is Vote Solar, Patty. And in case someone else is also in the back there, I have Clean Water Action to follow Patty. Patty, if you would introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Sounds good. Hello, my name is Patty O'Keefe. I am the, Hello, Chair Heintzman and committee members. My name is Patty O'Keefe. I'm the Midwest Regional Director at Vote Solar, an organization advocating for equitable solar as part of the transition to clean energy. Thank you for the opportunity today to testify in opposition to HF 28. HF 28 would allow data centers to be used as an excuse for prolonging fossil fuel dependence in Minnesota when we should be moving in the opposite direction. Data centers are some of the most energy and water intensive facilities in the world. A single large data center can require hundreds of diesel generators, each emitting nitrogen oxides and particulate matter that contribute to respiratory illness and environmental degradation. These generators cause significant localized pollution, disproportionately impacting nearby communities. The planned data centers for Minnesota could consume as much electricity as all 2.3 million households in the state. I know when I heard that, my jaw dropped. That's huge. Bottom line, if data center demand is expected to double our grid load and we allow that demand to be met with new fossil fuels, we are locking Minnesota into decades of increased emissions. The environmental consequences don't stop there. Data centers require massive amounts of water to cool their servers, up to 5 million gallons per day for a single facility. Microsoft's water consumption increased by 34% in just 1 year, and Google's by 22%, reaching over 5.5 billion gallons annually. This water is often treated with chemicals like PFAS to prevent corrosion and bacterial growth, making it unsuitable for drinking or agricultural use. This means we're not just consuming water at an unsustainable rate, we are removing it from the water cycle entirely. To be frank, this bill is being pushed by Amazon, a tech giant whose total revenue in 2024 was $638 billion. $638 billion. And they are working to try and get additional tax exemptions for Minnesota. I say this to underscore the point, and I'm just going to say it plainly. Amazon doesn't care about the health of our communities, the quality of our education system, the quality of our infrastructure. They don't care about the people or plants and animals that will absorb the pollution that their diesel generators spew out. I ask you to reject this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Clean Water Action. Ivana, please introduce yourself for the record.
Chair Heinzman, members of the committee, I'm Ivana Starkstead, Director of Clean Water Action Minnesota.
Might want to pull the mic a little bit closer.
I keep doing that today.
Your laptop is there. It's
there
a little hard.
There we go.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ivana Starkstead, Director of Clean Water Action Minnesota. I'm here on behalf of our tens of thousands of members to speak to House File 28 and appreciate this opportunity. It's no secret that data centers are popping up across the country as the dependency on cloud computing and AI increases. Ms. O'Keefe covered how many billions of dollars are being profited on and how many millions of gallons of water are being used, so I will skip right past that. Data centers operate 24/7, 365, and there are an estimated 5,300 facilities in the United States, and so this adds up to hundreds of billions of gallons of water used every year across the country. One AI query is estimated to use 16 ounces of fresh water. ChatGPT estimates upwards of 10 million queries a day, so 10 million times 16 ounces. The argument that data centers are popping up everywhere, so we should have to give them whatever they want, falls short with our members. We aren't unreasonable enough to say that data centers can be stopped, but we do think that they should pay their fair share in taxes and follow appropriate environmental review. We are at a pivotal point, and our water resources are limited. As we consider how to welcome multi-billion dollar companies into Minnesota, we shouldn't be asking how can we sacrifice enough to entice them, but rather pose the question, how will these businesses be good neighbors and honor our environment and our residents? We're also looking into job creation numbers because there was testimony earlier this morning in a different committee that noted that workers from outside the state would likely be shipped in to complete these builds. So we do have some concern over how many jobs are actually being created and maintained. Finally, much like PFAS, there are a lot of out-of-state lobbyists swarming around the Capitol on this issue, but they get to go home and they don't have to live with the consequences of this decision. If these companies want to operate in Minnesota, that means that we have the upper hand and that they can operate on our terms. So we do urge a no vote at this time. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And I believe the last testimony we have is from CURE. Sarah? Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Heinzman, committee members. My name is Sarah Moradian. I'm the Government Relations and Policy Director for CURE, a rurally based nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting and restoring resilient towns and landscapes by harnessing the power of the people who care about them. We appreciate the opportunity to testify in opposition to House File 28 today. 2 months ago, Amazon Data Services asked the Public Utilities Commission for expedited review of its request for an exemption to the typical certificate of need process required under Minnesota law. Amazon is seeking to build a hyperscale data center in Becker, as we've heard, and wants to have emergency backup generation available in the event that Xcel can't provide that power. According to the filing, Amazon will be building approximately 250 generators operating on polluting diesel fuel for a combined capacity of up to 600 megawatts, which is approximately the amount of electricity generated by the Monticello nuclear plant. Groups including CURE submitted comments to the PUC stating their position that a certificate of need is required in this instance. The PUC is holding a hearing on this tomorrow. But here we are discussing House File 28 in an apparent attempt to end run those discussions before the PUC. This bill would exempt any internal combustion engine used for emergency backup generation with a combined capacity greater than 50 megawatts from certificate of need proceedings. It would also allow for the minimal environmental review and expedited permitting under the standard or local review processes. This would allow for the construction of fossil fuel generation facilities of a size that we normally permit as a power plant without having to prove that the generation is needed, thoroughly evaluate its environmental and human health impacts, or establish that the same goal cannot be met through less harmful means. We appreciate the attempts made in the A4 amendment to clarify the role of AUARs, but remain concerned that an AUAR does not require the same level of analysis as a project-specific review. CURE urges this committee to think about the impetus of this bill, who would benefit from its passage, and who would be harmed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I will just make the offer to those in the audience today. If there's someone here that would like to testify, I see we do have at least one. Same rule would apply. We're trying to keep this to 2 minutes. Okay. So if you would like to introduce yourself for the record, and please go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Representative Heitzman and committee, for allowing me to testify today. I'm Kathy Johnson, and I represent the Coalition for Environmental, the Coalition for Responsible Data Center Development. I'm from Farmington, Minnesota. Our coalition is not opposed to data centers, but we are concerned about lack of regulation. I oppose HF 28 because it would allow local governing units to issue permits to construct energy backup generators. The bill would essentially avoid forms of environmental review for generators at a time when the PUC's authority should be enhanced and not bypassed. The AUAR is not environmentally robust, and that sentiment was supported by Sydney Lieb, Assistant Director of Commerce, when she addressed this bill just last Tuesday in committee. Permitting and regulation is a state issue, not a local one, and a Minnesota state agencies and legislators need to be the ones at the helm. Allowing the permitting of generators by LGUs would allow the same local units of government that are agreeing to non-disclosure agreements, guaranteeing water supplies, and asking for rezoning to also control this decision. I ask the House of Representatives to be in charge with bills demanding state oversight and state regulation, maintaining proper siting, use of technology to help abate problems which are prevalent and troublesome in data center campuses throughout the country. Allowing AUARs and other shortcuts to environmental regulation and permitting is inappropriate. It puts the needs of developers and wealthy corporations ahead of the welfare and the quality of life of your constituents. This is a time for strict regulations for permitting, demand environmental impact statements, and for the publicly elected legislature to be at the helm of decision making regarding Minnesota's resources, and in particular, the tax dollars and quality of life of your constituents. Not developers from out of state, the legislature needs to be for the people. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And members, I'm not seeing any other folks from the audience, so I'm going to move on to your questions, and I have Representative Jordan first on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, Representative Mequin, what are the main differences between an AUAR and an EAW-EIS process? Like, how are those different?
Representative Mequin, if you want to respond, or you would like a testifier to respond, just have them on deck if you would like that. Go ahead.
Yep. So, Becker did an extensive AUAR in 2023, I believe, and through the conversations with the different state departments, some of that was okay, some of it what they wanted to still have purview over. And that is where this entire agreement came between the PUC, the MPCA, and whichever Department of Commerce, and whoever else was all involved, EQB. And so perhaps Catherine can explain the vivid detail of that.
Director, if you would reintroduce yourself for the record and go ahead if you would like to respond.
Yes, again, Mr. Chair, Catherine Neuscher, Executive Director of the EQB. To Representative Jordan's question, the AUAR is only allowed for projects that are residential, commercial, warehousing, and light industrial projects. And it is meant to be, it is meant to have an EIS level of analysis for the kinds of environmental impacts that are typical of those sort of local development projects. AUARs also can only be conducted by local governments. So anything else, any industrial facility that triggers any of the other mandatory categories for environmental review, whether it's water appropriations, whether it's air appropriations, whether it's power plants, cannot be included in an AUAR. If it is subject to environmental review for another mandatory category, it needs to go through whatever other processes are relevant, whether that's an EAW or an EIS or the processes that are under PUC and commerce authorities that I would have to let them speak to.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We answer my next question, which is what other permits are granted under the AUAR? So it's like light industrial on down, and an AUAR process is conducted by a unit of government that is not the state, so like a city or a county.
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jordan, I believe it's usually cities, but yes, okay. It's a local government.
Anything further, Representative Jordan?
Yes, Mr. Chair. And so is there a public comment period as part of an AUAR process?
Director.
Yes, there is.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it the same public comment process as an EAW EIS?
Director Musler.
Oh, Mr. Chair, Representative Jordan, I don't know exactly off the top of my head, but it's pretty similar. The local government has to do an order for review and sort of say what they're going to include, and then they have to go through a public process for the actual analysis. I'm not familiar if it exactly lines up, but I think it's pretty close. Yes.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I guess I have kind of some follow-up questions. Who are those comment periods open to? Are they just open to, you know, residents of like the city of Minneapolis or the city that is conducting the AUAR? And then when we're talking about projects that are governed by an AUAR, how does the energy and water consumption of those projects compare to a data center, for example, or a power plant?
Director,
or some of those other larger projects.
Director, and before you answer, I'll just quickly remind the committee we're trying to get this done in round two. So if we have more questions, just be ready if I'm trying to get to another one. I'm not trying to be disrespectful. Director, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Jordan, I mean, I think it's up to the cities. I'm not aware that anyone restricts their public comment period only to their residents or anything. But it's the cities and run their public comment periods. They submit the materials to the EQB. We publish them in the EQB monitor, and we let people know that there's a comment period and where to send their comments. I'm not sure that I can answer your second question in terms of, like, the impacts, but again, if there's things that have separate triggers, they often can't be considered in an AUAR if they trigger for other reasons, like such as large water use. But I don't know the precise comparison.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, this is helpful. I don't understand why a project as large as a data center would be exempt from other parts of environmental review. That seems a little ridiculous to me. I'm not really sure why this bill is necessary. There's already a permitting process for data centers, correct?
Director.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jordan, I mean, I'm not familiar with what the precise permits are for data centers. I think in this case, we are talking about separate environmental review for, like, the data center building and the emergency backup generation. So I just want to be clear about that.
Thank you. That's helpful. Thank you.
Just to make sure, Lead Fisher, did you want to wrap, or are there others?
No.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Meckland. So, you know, there's been a lot of reference to Becker here, but the way the bill's written, could it be anywhere? I mean, can this process would be for additional sites anywhere all the time? Would that, or is it only for the one site?
Representative Meckland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The scope of this is to clarify the language for the review process with backup generation for this particular very specific industry, that of data centers.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, and maybe a nonpartisan staff could answer that, would it apply to any other data center anywhere else in the state?
Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members, this would apply statewide. This is not specific to Becker.
Representative Hansen.
And then, forgive me, Mr. Chair, but so we're talking about data centers. How does this relate to maybe cryptocurrency mining, or is that something where this would be eligible if people are working on cryptocurrency?
Representative Meckland, I didn't expect a mining discussion today, but go ahead and take a crack at that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I know absolutely nothing about cryptocurrency.
Representative Hanson.
I haven't had any conversations with any of them about cryptocurrency, and I'm quite frankly don't understand it. So,
Representative Hanson.
Mr. Chair, is there anyone in the audience who would, if a data center is being used for, or this type of production can be used for Bitcoin mining or other cryptocurrency production?
Not seeing anyone rising to that particular question. Representative Hanson, that might be something you have to look into after today's hearing, potentially. I don't see anyone.
Sometimes when we...
Representative Hanson.
Mr. Chair, sometimes when we do things, it has other consequences.
Lead Fisher, any other member questions?
Not seeing anything. Thank you, Chair Heinzman. I do have a few questions. A lot of it is around the water reuse. I know that our water use for the data centers. I know that from what I've seen that they can use quite a bit. This bill is silent on that. I was wondering what is happening in terms of water use. How much water are we looking at the facilities using? Where is it coming from? Like to be able to get some information on that because we have different agencies that regulate water use here and permit water use in the state.
Representative Mecklen, to you or a testifier?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So to that issue, I do believe there is a closed-loop system in play in this particular scenario. That's what I've heard about. I don't know the specifics on it, but that is a new thing that we're seeing nationwide on data centers. So they don't have the water usage. You basically fill it once, and it just keeps circulating. Otherwise, I would guess that perhaps, and I'm guessing and speculating because I don't know. I mean, some of this stuff is we haven't had these conversations. However, I know nearby other facilities pull water out of the Mississippi River. They pump it through. It goes through a series of pipes, and it's cooled back down to within 5 degrees and put back in the Mississippi River.
Lead Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Heinzman. And the reason I'm asking, because I'm hearing that in some that the possibility that they might be reusing water or non-potable water. And the reason I'm asking this is it's important from several different reasons, is how is the water being handled, how is it being treated, where does it go? And if they're using non-potable water, have they consulted with the Department of Human or the Department of Health? Department of Health regulates what the water standards are for reuse of water, having run into that issue in our local community. And it seems to me this is kind of a big part of what's going to happen in the bill. If we're dealing with water issues here, and I'm not hearing how much we're using. I'm not hearing, are we closed system, open system? I've heard from, you know, when Amazon was talking to me earlier today, they said they might be using non-potable water. Raises a lot of questions for me. And these are important questions, I think, that need to be answered before we can move this bill forward. Do you have somebody that can come forward to answer some of these questions?
Representative Mecklen, anyone that wants to
Mr. Chair, I do not believe so.
Lead Fisher.
Most of these items are purview of our committee, particularly when we're getting into permitting of water. I cannot feel comfortable allowing this bill to go forward if we don't have the answers in the water use area. I know it's important to address data centers. At the same time, I think there's some important things that are not being covered here, and I move to lay the bill on the table until we have these answers. And roll call.
That's a non-debatable motion. There will be a roll call. Mr. Yang, if you could take the roll.
Chair Heinzman?
No.
Vice Chair Burkle?
No.
Lee Fisher?
Yes.
Representative Falconer?
Yes.
Representative Finke?
Yes.
Representative Gilman?
No.
Representative Hanson?
Yes.
Representative Jacob?
No.
Representative Jordan?
Aye.
Representative Nelson?
No.
Representative Purcell?
Purcell, aye.
Representative Schultz?
No.
Representative Warwas?
No.
There are 6 yes and 7 no. The motion does not prevail. Lee Fisher, I do want to mentioned that I think that the water permit process is somewhat separate, a separate process and quite thorough. I do also think that having the conversation today was important. I'm glad that we're talking about water use, and there'll be, I expect more conversations to be had on that, and I'll join you in seeking that. So, Lead Fisher, if you have more comments.
Thank you, Chair Heitzman. I'm glad you recognize the water issue here, and this kind of raises the issue that I see with the bill, is that it does not feel to me to be ready, because while we're dealing with one part of the issue, water use, water reuse is a huge issue that falls into the purview of this committee, that we need to be having discussions on how it's being done, how it's being treated, to make sure it's done in a responsible way. Because as we're hearing, is some of the things that are being done here is setting up what the framework is going to be going forward for data centers. And while there's a need for data centers out there, I want to make sure we're getting it right, because I know in some communities people would come back to haunt us if we didn't get this right, particularly when in some areas of our state we do have water shortages and problems with the current underlying water system.
Thank you, Lead Fisher. So, members, the next motion would be to re-refer this bill to the General Register, and I am amending my earlier motion to do that in light of the testimony that we heard earlier from the CQB that there's no cost to the bill. So rather than Ways and Means, my motion then would be to amend my previous motion and refer to the General Register as I just stated. So
roll call.
Roll call being requested. We will take the roll.
Chair Heinzman?
Yes.
Vice Chair Burkle?
Yes.
Lee Fisher?
Nope.
Representative Falconer?
Nope.
Representative Finke?
No.
Representative Gilman?
Yes.
Representative Hansen?
No.
Representative Jacob?
Yes.
Representative Jordan?
Nope.
Representative Nelson?
Yes.
Representative Purcell?
Purcell, no.
Representative Schultz?
Aye.
Representative Warwas?
Yes.
The vote being 7 yeses and 6 noes, the bill is re-referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Meckland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and
we
members.
We are on to House File 819. Representative Schultz, if you would like to go to the testifier's desk. And if those that planned on testifying could be getting ready. Representative Schultz, it looks like you're just about ready there. Representative Schultz moves that House File 819 be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill. I do see that there's an author's delete everything amendment. Representative Schultz, would you like your amendment to move so we can get the bill in the shape that you would like for today's presentation?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move the DE2 amendment.
Any comments, members? All those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Schultz, the bill is in the shape that you would like. If you would begin your testimony, that would be great.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Pleased to offer House File 819, which is a very bipartisan bill in both bodies of the legislature today. And thank you for the adoption of the author's amendment, which really seeks to clarify a lot of additional detail and will assist us as this conversation moves forward. In seeking to establish a task force to look at the rules and regulations and the access to the people of Minnesota as it relates to their interest in foraging. So concern has been raised by folks across the state and by folks in the community that
do forge, and I know there are several members of this community in this committee, who are foragers themselves, and so this is really getting to the concerns that have been raised by the community over several years, members, that frankly the voices of those in the community are not currently being heard within the realm of our state agency at the DNR, and so it is this concern that we are seeking to address with the establishment of this task force. And so, like I mentioned, this has been years in the making. I first heard from constituents about this in 2023, about the possibility of the DNR severely limiting access to foraging in state parks. It was initially, I was initially contacted by one of my constituents and who is also a member of the Minnesota Mycological Society about those concerns with the DNR, which appeared to be unwilling to have any real dialogue with all of the stakeholders. And by the way, there's an immense interest in this, and your packets include letters to that end today, that there really wasn't any desire to have a real dialogue about this. And so that's why we have brought ourselves to this moment, so that we can understand what should be the true access to our state lands for a very variety of uses. And so I'm authoring this legislation to help build that task force to ensure that we have a transparent process that will be based on data and science and is used to develop the new regulations in regards to foraging. And I want to make clear that the advocates of this bill have told me repeatedly that they are in no way against new regulations or potentially quantity limits, but simply want to be at the table as regulations are determined, and that this process is ultimately, members, data-driven and transparent, which they currently have not felt that it is. So we know, and we've discussed in this community, this committee before, that the DNR has a stated mission to work with Minnesotans to conserve and manage the state's natural resources, to provide outdoor recreation opportunities, and to provide for commercial uses of natural resources in a way that creates a sustainable quality of life. And I believe that a collaborative rulemaking aligns with this mission by ensuring continued access while protecting the resources. So, once again, appreciate the chance to have House File 819 in front of us today, and I know we have a number of testifiers to this. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and I look forward to a robust discussion.
Thank you, Representative Schultz. And first up is Peter from MMS. If you would like to introduce yourself for the record. Next up is Alan. And Peter, if you would, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Thank you, Chairman. Chairman Heitzman and Representative Schultz, committee members. My name is Peter Martignacco, and I'm the current president of the Minnesota Mycological Society. And I thank you for the opportunity to comment on HF 819. The Minnesota Mycological Society was founded in 1899, and for 125 years, our mission has been to study and educate the public about fungi, including teaching identification to safely gather mushrooms for food. I want to make our position totally clear that we believe there's a need for thoughtful policy and regulation to guide the future management of this outdoor pursuit. This is not adequately being addressed in the current regulation. The understanding of foraging in Minnesota has generally come from those that have long cultural traditions of foraging. Our indigenous communities easily come to mind, but also many immigrant communities have long traditions of foraging that they seek to share in their new home. The Hmong, Karen, Vietnamese, East African, and West African communities, as well as immigrants from Eastern Europe, all come from long, passionate cultural foraging traditions. Foraging is much more part of Minnesotans' lives than we may realize. In a survey in northern Wisconsin, one in three residents had done foraging in the previous 12 months. Thousands of Minnesotans harvest wild rice. Many of us had our first introduction for foraging picking berries. Thousands travel to pick blueberries every year. And while not generally pursued on public lands, maple syruping is another activity that has many participants. What do we know about the sustainability of foraging? While not widespread activity today in the United States, foraging for personal use has been done sustainably for hundreds of years all over the world. in times past has been done without management. However, in our society today, we must be mindful of many factors, and this is the reason we've been brought together, like-minded Minnesotans, to advocate for thoughtful policies and regulation. Hunting and fishing share the same passion and bond to the outdoors as foraging does, all while supporting and fostering interest in the close connections to nature, gifts, natural gifts that our state has blessed us with. I want to again thank the committee for supporting this, the establishment of this task force. As Minnesotans, we can show our leadership in recognizing the value of foraging as part of our connection to the outdoors. And I am happy to answer any questions now or at any time in the future.
Thank you for your testimony. Next is Alan, if you would introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Chair Heitzman, Representative Schultz, and members of the committee. My name is Alan Burgo, but people around the world know me professionally as the Forager Chef. I'm from Minnesota, and I'm based in St. Paul. I appreciate the opportunity to speak before you today in support of House File 819, which would have established the Minnesota Sustainable Foraging Task Force. As a chef who has dedicated his career to celebrating native Midwestern ingredients and sustainable foraging culinary practices, and as someone honored with the James Beard Award for that work, I've seen firsthand how Minnesota's natural bounty fuels creativity, builds tradition, and fosters community connection in our kitchens and beyond. This legislation is needed because it seems Minnesota's Department of Natural Resources feels that the tradition of foraging isn't an acceptable use of state lands. I asked the Minnesota DNR, where is the average person supposed to forage? You shouldn't have to be a land baron in order to experience the bounty that our state land provides. This legislation smartly calls for a task force to develop scientifically sound, data-driven recommendations for foraging on state lands, and this is both timely and essential. Interest in nature is growing, and that's a really good thing. By balancing ecological sustainability with the public's right to access our state's abundant natural resources, this bill ensures that foraging practices continue to contribute to our local food culture and foraging traditions without compromising the health of our ecosystems. I also think the thoughtful structure of the bill is notable. The task force's diverse membership, ranging from legislative representatives and scientific experts in botany, ecology, environmental science, representatives of indigenous communities, as well as local foraging experts, ensures that recommendations will be comprehensive, culturally sensitive, and rooted in both scientific evidence and sustainable traditions. Developing educational materials on sustainable foraging practices will empower Minnesotans, from professional chefs to community members, to forage responsibly. Furthermore, a possible permitting model that includes a volunteer option for foraging permits is a creative solution that ensures equitable access while promoting conservation. I strongly support this legislation and its collaborative approach, and I urge you to pass this bill so Minnesotans can continue to enjoy our state's natural bounty in a way that's both responsible and inspiring. Thanks for your time and consideration.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next up, we have from Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, Greg, if you could make your way. Please introduce yourself for the record. And normally I see you back home in district, but today in committee. Proceed yes. with your testimony.
Thank you. My name's Greg Qualley. I'm a representative from Minnesota Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. We're your voice for public lands, water, and wildlife, and also access to those resources that state and federal governments hold in trust for all of us. We support House File 819 for two reasons. One, primarily because this is an issue that's going to become much more controversial in the future, and I want to commend Minnesota for being one of the first states, according to my research, that's actually dealing with this issue in a comprehensive fashion. And secondly, and more importantly, you're taking an approach to this where you're involving the public before the government agencies have a chance or an opportunity to promulgate rules and laws that would preempt or at least limit the public's ability to have input at the beginning of this process. So this process, although not novel, the formation of a task force within individuals and representatives from different organizations is an important step in how to manage natural resources in Minnesota. And I'll just give a brief aside here. Thank you for your introduction of this bill, and thank you for hearing it, Chairman Heinzen. And I was before this committee last year when the bill for the reorganization of the Fish and Wildlife Budget Committee was heard. And I was somewhat chastised for my approach, saying that I think everybody should be included in discussions. And it created some controversy, in particular with Representative Jordan, and I would like to publicly apologize if I embarrassed her or if I offended her in my testimony last year. But I feel extremely passionate about the public's involvement in natural resource management. And if that was out of line, I apologize, but I think it was important, because I may have misspoke last year, and I wanted to personally apologize to this committee if that was the case. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on deck, I think I have Erickson Public Affairs. All right, go ahead and introduce yourself for the record. And
all right, good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tim Clemens. I am an independent foraging educator. I established my foraging education business, Ironwood Foraging, in 2017 to create profound connections between people, plants, and mushrooms. In partnership with over 50 organizations, I have personally taught foraging skills to over 14,000 Minnesotans. HF 819 leverages diverse expertise to create a task force of knowledgeable and experienced stakeholders to participate in a transparent process of fact-finding and collaboration with the Minnesota DNR. This bill therefore supports creating policy that is scientific, data-driven, and culturally coherent. Collaborative rulemaking helps foster public trust and cooperation, encourages sustainable practices, and aligns with the Minnesota DNR's stated mission of fostering a connection between people and nature. Foraging is proven to increase volunteerism, promote nature ethics, and build self-efficacy in Minnesotans. Therefore, this tradition and living practice is of great benefit to our public lands, water, ecology, and people, with immensely positive second and third order benefits. It is my sincere hope that HF 819 is praised for centuries to come for its foresight and proactive support of Minnesota's native species and the lifeway of reciprocal conservation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Erickson.
Thank you.
You would introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schultz and members of the committee. My name is Tara Erickson, and I'm a member of the Minnesota Mycological Society, but I've also worked here in state government, lobbying and public affairs for 25 years. I am volunteering my time to lead the advocacy around this legislation. Thank you for allowing me to testify on this bill. This legislation has been a few years in the making. Around this same time in 2023, I found out about possible new regulations severely limiting foraging activities in state parks by reading a Minnesota Mycological Society newsletter, and I immediately contacted the organization to understand what was happening and to see if I could be of any assistance, even though I have never worked on an environmental issue in my life. If you're in healthcare, you would always see me there. What I found out was that the Minnesota DNR at the time was apparently not willing to talk with stakeholders, and that they were looking at doing new rules that would severely restrict foraging on state lands. I wanted to find out what was going on, and I immediately said that I would volunteer to help with my time. We were unsuccessful in getting a meeting until I was able to start getting some news stories around the issue, and we sent a formal letter to the governor's office requesting their assistance to see if the DNR would meet with us. And I do want to thank the governor's staff, because we were able to meet with the DNR once in August of 2023. During that meeting, the possibility of new quantity limits was raised, and the DNR said that they were potentially considering a 1-gallon bag limit. I asked the DNR staff where that particular limit came from, and we didn't really get much of an answer other than they were trying to come up with something reasonable. I told the DNR that the reason why that limit was a little troublesome for us was because there are a number of mushrooms that we forage that just simply do not fit into a gallon bag. And the response to that was, really? And I said, yes, that is why we would like to be at the table if there need to be any new regulations. At the roundtable discussion last month, initially we had been told that they were only looking at rules for state parks, and they said that the rules were not coming out because they were now looking at that for all state lands. So we do want everybody to know that we want this to be collaborative, and the reason why the amendment added two more people from the DNR to the task force was because we found out that they were looking at additional lands and all state lands, and so we want this to be as collaborative as possible and thought it would be better to have more people from other divisions other than just state parks on this. Lastly, I love foraging. I grew up on the Iron Range of Minnesota. Nature has been a huge part of my life. I do it with my boys who are 11 and 13. They try and compete with each other in the early spring to see who's going to find the first morel mushroom. We want to have kids in nature. It is very important. They're on screens all the time, and it's not good for them. So, and lastly, all of these people that I have been working with, trying to herd cats to get all of these people to work together, I call them nature nerds. They are brilliant. They know everything about these plants. It is super fun. I hope to be one day, a nature nerd. And they would just, their skills and their knowledge are going to just be really important to have at a table when we are looking at new rules like this. So thank you for doing this, Bill, and I really hope that we get your support. Thank you.
That was great. Thank you for your testimony. I have to say I'm like feeling like I'm maybe missing out. I spend a lot of time in the outdoors, but these things, foraging has been a little bit of a scary thought, so... It's fun to see so many that are actively working on this and testifying here today. I do want to have DNR come forward now and give them an opportunity to weigh in. Assistant Commissioner.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. For the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources Assistant Commissioner. Thank you for the time to testify on this important bill. I'm going to start by saying, as you're familiar with our mission statement, we work with Minnesotans across the state to protect, conserve, and utilize our natural resources. This is a big part of that. You've heard that this goes back to 2023, where we were proposing rules within the state parks. After observing large volumes of groups or people, sometimes as many as 80 to 100, coming to a single park to collect, along with the general increase of foraging along within the public. The numbers of these parks coming into state parks year after year going to the same areas can cause significant impacts. We've seen some people foraging within our state parks, collecting quantities as much as 20 pounds of material to share and eat with others. We've also seen impacts to food sources from foraging to mammals, arthropods, and birds that rely on these materials to eat. Those rules, we did discuss with the Mycological Society in January of 2024. Commissioner Strelman sent Mr. Martin Goggle a letter expressing our desires to work with them and learning from them. Since that time, those rules have been put on hold. They dealt with state parks. As you know, the purposes of a state park are to protect into perpetuity those natural resources that exist within a state park. Just for the record, we have 4.2 million acres of state forests, 1.37 million acres of wildlife management areas, and 235,000 acres of state parks. Outdoor recreations and parks are supposed to, by statute in the Outdoor Recreation Act, utilize the natural features of the park that can be accommodated without material disturbance of the natural features of the park or introduction of undue artificiality into the natural scene. Park use shall be primarily for aesthetic, cultural and educational purposes, and shall not be designed to accommodate all forms or unlimited volumes of recreational use. We support foraging. We support foraging on all of our state lands. We are concerned about our state parks being loved to death.
which began the work in 2023. To say that we don't support foraging is just false. I'm an active wild rice harvester. I'm a trapper. I love being outside, and I collect edibles when I can. Looking at the work that we're doing to strengthen our work, we began an internal working team, and actually we held a public town hall with Senator Faw and others in October of 2024 to express these views and continue working with the population. The values formed on our foraging team project definition is that we recognize the need to manage foraging differently across different state-managed land types. And we must consider resource management expertise, state law, statutes, and stakeholder partner feedback when considering improvements. So we value all the statements that have been made. We do not have an active rulemaking in progress. State statute allows for these uses where applicable. For example, on state forest lands of 4.3 million acres, there are very little restrictions. We also don't have baseline data for many of the species that are needed to properly inform these recommendations. For example, Solomon seal, fiddleheads, and ramps. There's no population data on how harvesting might affect populations or impact other species in the ecosystem. So there's more information needed to come up with this data that the task force would recommend. And we would need resources to identify those. We will also need resources to run the task force. The fiscal note will be coming shortly to this committee, and we can discuss that at the time of putting the budget together. But it will not be cheap. There's a substantial amount of work that needs to be done. We envision 2 to 3 FTEs needed for the time of the task force. And then if there are rulemaking or legislative activities, there would be additional costs there. I can go on, Mr. Chair. I know you have another bill to hear, but we support foraging. We're working with the Alliance and folks on these issues. I view the bill as a solution in search of a problem, so to speak, since we have a lot of this in statute right now, and perhaps we should be looking at funding research to develop that baseline information on the species that are so important to people doing these activities, rather than allowing the expanded use. Additionally, the permitting discussion to create a permit regulatory system would require financial resources. And we look forward with you to working with you on this bill and finding those resources within your budget in the future.
Thank you, Commissioner, for your testimony today, and I'm sure there'll be a question or two. So before I do that, I'm just going to ask quickly, is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify to the bill? All right, seeing none. Members, Representative Hansen, you're first on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and you know, being involved in these discussions for a couple years, fascinating to be at this point. You know, I was thinking to myself as a hunter, because it was referenced about hunting and angling, I have to buy a license. I can go shoot 2 pheasants, but I can't sell them. I can't sell those pheasants. And I think there's a question here of foraging for personal consumption or commercial foraging. And I'll flat out say I don't want commercial foraging on our public lands. Mm-hmm. I don't want somebody making money going out there and harvesting what belongs to all of us. I'm also a little bit concerned about making money or having the for-profit business to take people onto the public lands. Because if somebody guides me onto a wildlife management area, I mean, I don't want to pay somebody to guide me onto public lands. So I don't see a difference between the mushroom and the pheasant or the mushroom and the deer. They belong to the people when they're on the public lands. And Representative Schultz, I appreciate what you've done here. This is a classic task force. Classic Minnesota solution of let's put everybody on who has an input and have the agency prepare it. And you've got the House and Senate. I would take the House and the Senate legislators off there, just frankly. But I can give you what the recommendation will probably be. It'll be we need to keep the task force going after the task force report with ongoing funding. And that there needs to be more money spent and more study
I think probably what's needed is a generic environmental impact statement on foraging to look at what's being done now and what the impacts are on our public lands. And maybe this is overall on our public lands, how they're being impacted by humans. We have a lot more people in the state now than we used to have. And foraging is fun. But how much can the resource take? So I don't know, Mr. Chair, is this being laid over or is this moving out?
Laid over.
So I think there's clearly something that has to be done here because there's high demand from the public. How do you protect the public resource and not have regulatory capture where the result are, hey, let's go foraging? We need to have something that's science-based. I appreciate that from some of the testifiers. But I want to make sure that that Minnesota's resources that belong to everybody are not being used to enrich some people with those public resources.
Representative Hansen, just confirming that was more of a statement. There's no question for the testifier.
Well, Representative Schultz was kind of smiling there. I thought he was going to respond that is he willing to work on changing this, or are you saying this is you've come off Mount Sinai with the solution and that this can't be changed?
Representative Hansen, I didn't see any tablets when he came in the door. So, Representative Schultz, if you would like to clarify for the record where you just were.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen. You had a lot of excellent commentary there, and I think that at the end of the day, we want to work together on this and find the right solution. I tend to agree with a lot of your sentiments, and I think that we can find the right path for us moving forward, and I think that those discussions will continue in this committee.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing this bill. I fancy myself a bit of a forager as well. I echo a lot of the sentiment from Representative Hansen. I guess, so thinking about how I learned to forage and how different folks of different cultural backgrounds have different ways of foraging, there's a way to do it with a look to future generations and future seasons so as not to totally decimate that food. So I do think there is room as possible to find common ground. I have a question for the Commissioner of the DNR, Mr. Chair. So lines 3.6 to 3.9, the subdivision 7, the consideration of recommendations. So it says the Commissioner of Natural Resources must incorporate and implement the recommendations of the task force in any rulemaking related to foraging or must state the reasons for not doing so as part of the rulemaking process. Feels like maybe there's some history here that I'm unaware of, which is just fine, but I'm wondering if that is a typical kind of ultimatum given to a task force in relationship with the Department of Natural Resources. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Assistant Commissioner, and then I will probably ask Representative Schultz if he also wants to respond after the Commissioner. Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell, thank you very much. And as I stated in the beginning of my testimony, we have no formal rulemaking going on right now, nor do we have any intended to go on. Chapter 14 rulemaking process does allow ample opportunity for public comment, public testimony, written formal public meetings as well, so that would take place as well. These two sections make it seem like this task force has a perceived conception of what they want to see in the rule and done here, much like perhaps the lines of Representative Hansen was speaking. So that does raise some concern with us. And also just briefly for the record, the language on 2.3 and 2.4 dealing with Minnesota tribes or tribal nations in past task force, they want to all be represented. So I would also make a recommendation or a consideration that we expand those to all, one member from each Minnesota Ojibwe tribe and one member from each Dakota tribe.
Representative Schultz, if you had anything otherwise.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Purcell. When considering this, especially in the subdivision 7, as you referenced, the concern here is that we're dealing with different types of public land, from parks to forests, and we want to ensure that what the recommendations are implemented appropriately across those different sectors.
Representative Purcell. Lead Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Heintzman and Assistant Commissioner Meyer. Kind of hit what I was going to talk on is I noticed that it's one member from each of the from the Ojibwe tribe, one from the Dakota, and we've got 11 different tribes. And on a number of issues, it's not unusual. You can get sometimes five or six different opinions. So it'd be nice to have a way to make sure that each of the tribes have a way to have some kind of input into it, just because of how they may be seeing it from their point of view in their respective treaty areas. So I just want to kind of mention that out there.
Mr. Chair, just want you to know that I got that language from Representative Heather Keeler, who that was what she recommended to me. So as a member of a tribal nation, she thought that was, I took her recommendation, but very open.
Members, anything further before we close it out? All right, Representative Schultz, I'll give you the closing thoughts before we move on with the motion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the members of the committee, and to everyone who offered testimony, whether in written or oral testimony this afternoon, very valuable, and look forward to seeing this bill through the process. Thank you for your support, Mr. Chair.
All right, members, Representative Schultz renews his motion that HF 819 be laid over. The bill is laid over. Next up, Representative Gilman. It's good to see you at the table, Representative Gilman. Members, Representative Gilman moves that HF 944 be recommended to be placed on the general register. Representative Gilman, before you start, I see that you have an author's amendment. Members, it's the A1 if you're looking in your packet. I would move your amendment to get the bill in the shape that you would like for today's discussion. Members, any thoughts or concerns on the A1? All right, seeing none, all those in favor of the A1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The A1 is carried, and the bill is in the shape that you would like. Representative Gilman, if you'd like to proceed with your testimony and with your testifiers, go right ahead.
Wonderful. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm so happy to bring forward House File 944. Quick description on this bill. This bill would expand the options to mark or denote the boundaries of private property. It would allow landowners to mark trees on the edge of their property or posts with purple paint. This would be a differing option to just having no trespassing signs. Purple paint is arguably longer lasting, more visible, and not as easily removed. The purple paint markings must be vertical lines 8 inches or longer and at least 1 inch wide. The bottom of the line must be at least 3 feet off the ground and placed in locations that are readily visible to anyone approaching the property. They must not be more than 100 feet apart on forest land or more than 1,000 feet apart on other lands. 22 states already have provisions in their state laws, and I'm just really excited to have our testifier here to go in depth a little bit more and open to any comments.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Gilman. To your testifier, please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, I'm Lieutenant Colonel Robert Grecki, Assistant Director for the DNR Enforcement Division. Mr. Chair, I'll keep my comments brief. The DNR is supportive of any changes to our current trespassing laws and that makes it easier for landowners and the public to be aware of where trespassing is not allowed. This bill would provide landowners an additional method to post their property and let them know where the current boundaries are. There are many states, as already mentioned, that currently use a purple paint trespassing method and have generally been well received by both landowners and the public. In addition to this bill, the A1 amendment is greatly appreciated, and that will still provide the landowner's name and phone number at a convenient road access point that'll make it easy for the public to know whose land it is. It should be easy to for that person to maintain that sign, as well as prevent people from just marking trees purple where they may not have legal authority to do so, such as public lands or other places. The DNR is supportive of this bill, and we appreciate the author for bringing this forward. I would be remiss if I didn't mention, though, that we have been approached by other groups that are interested in putting the responsibility of knowing where someone is on the public and not as much on the landowner, and we'd be certainly willing to share that with this legislative body in the future if requested. And with that, I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you very much. Before we do that, I'm just looking around. Anybody from the public that would like to testify on the bill? All right, seeing none. Members, questions? Representative Hansen, you are first.
I just was looking around the room if Big Paint was in the room.
Members, Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would love more context on this. My favorite color is purple, but there's a lot of variety in that color, and I guess it's difficult for some people who are colorblind, so I'm interested in additional context of how this has been implemented in other states. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gilbert, or your testifier?
If you want, I can. Mr. Chair, Representative Purcell. Yeah, so purple is not generally a color that's used by forestry or logging operations. So, again, that's one of the reasons. Purple, generally, again, I'm not a medical professional. With people that are blue-green, colorblind can see purple. I do understand your concern of different shades of purple, but I think it's generally well-received in other states and it's worked well.
Representative Purcell?
I also have one more comment on that as well.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. I also did a little research thanks to Rep. Fisher and I having a conversation about this ahead of time. A person with pro-tan type color blindness tends to see greens, yellows, oranges, reds, and browns, and purple colors can look more like blue. And I did have a graphic made, and I know that there might be one member on the other side, that one of our colleagues that is colorblind. So I wanted you to get that to one of the members just to see. I just wanted to have some different ideas of just varying different colors of purple, and I did a lot more research on that as well. And that's why we did bring the A1 forward as well. So there would be signs posted on the corners or on a trail entrance with a phone number as well. Thank you.
Representative Purcell, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My follow up is I'm glad to hear about precedent in other states, but also, of course, purple is very special to Minnesota. So I'm really, of all the colors, it's a great choice from this end. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for bringing this bill for Representative Gilman. I know years back I lived in Kansas, and at that time they had gone to allowing purple paint on their fence post for a no trespassing. And it's, you know, they've got very similar regulations, you know, especially with the amendment, you know, for allowing that. And it's, you know, it's long lasting. It's probably better than a tire painted no trespassing hanging over a fence post. But, you know, I think it's something that is it's useful and it works well. And I think it's a good bill.
Representative Falconer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing this bill forward. I think it does alleviate some concerns as far as people tearing down trespassing signs and then, you know, having the, oh, I didn't know. My concern kind of with the colorblind thing, but then also with my own experience, you know, going out pre-dawn deer hunting with my red light on, because of course deer can't see red light, is purple still viewable with a red light? I'm just wondering also then, which maybe gets to the point of people should be more responsible knowing what land they're accessing. So that's, you know, an aside kind of that. But I'm just wondering if, in addition to purple marking, if there could be a simple modification just of denoting a shape of some sort that is very much specific to no trespassing, like a triangle of whatever it would be, mean, or, you know, a line in a circle, something like that, that just means that specifically is no trespassing, potentially to alleviate some of the colorblind issues, but then also in low light situations or with headlamps that are going to make it difficult to discern between different colors.
Representative Falconer, that's an interesting question, and I have struggled with that myself, even with conventional signage, trying to read it, especially if it's faded, which is quite often the case because they do wear down. But Colonel or Representative Gilman?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a challenging thing. Obviously, when we're painting trees, they're not flat. They're not flush. It is difficult to do different shapes. I can appreciate the concern. I don't know. I think it depends on what the material that the paint is made out of, whether it'll be UV reflective or not.
So I Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. And I'd like to just comment as well. It will have a shape. It states in the bill 8 inches long by 1 inch. So it'd be a vertical strip painted. And that's a great question on the red light. I could totally get back to you on that. Again, a lot of folks that are hunting, trapping, using hiking, you know, going on property, a lot of folks use apps called Onyx and, you know, Hunt Stand or HuntWise apps, but not everybody does. I'll just share one quick personal experience. The reason I'm excited to bring this bill forward is there's over 1,000 hunting accidents that happen in any given year across the nation, which could injure or kill people. And each year, you know, whatever we could do to make things safer so people could get home. I was personally involved in an incident where I was out pre-dawn, way early, and in my spot on my bucket waiting for that buck to come through. And so excited when, yes, indeed, the buck did come through. And I was pulled up on the deer that I was going to harvest, and then shots rang out in on my property. And I did not, where I was angled by my tree, did not see the young man that happened to be in the same piece of property that I was on. So I did proceed to go forward after that. And he did tag that small deer that he said, well, you can tag it. And so again, when I saw how many hunting accidents there could be, I was also, you know, potentially in an area where I could have been injured myself and not got home to my 5 kids and my husband. I thought this is amazing, and purple would be great for the state of Minnesota as well.
Lead Fisher, anything?
Thank you, Chair Heinzman. Thank you, Representative Gilman, for being creative and figuring out other ways to address it. You know that I've been one over the years that has been very much as, you know, the public should be checking before they go on the property. I appreciate you finding another way to start addressing the problem. While I still would prefer people to check beforehand, I think this is a good way to address the problem where we have signs that keep on disappearing. So this is very helpful to have this going forward. One of the questions I have is, you know, we've talked a little bit about the color blindness, and I appreciate the research you've done on the issue going forward and try making sure that it's more of a clear symbol. What I'm wondering is as we go forward after, if this gets through the process, it gets passed at the end, is there a time frame that we need to help educate the public before we would implement something like that? And how would we help get the information out? Would this be something that the DNR would usually issue when they're giving out deer hunting permits, et cetera, where they could, and if it's something they could incorporate in there as they're, you know, updating things, to have some kind of picture so if somebody's colorblind, they know what they're looking for type. I'm just trying to offer out some thoughts and how that might be incorporated in.
Lee Fisher, I think that might be a DNR question. I'll just go with the Colonel.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, yes, thank you for the question. Absolutely. And like any new laws that are new, there's a big educational piece that comes along with it, whether that's with the conservation officers in the field, educating the public while they're out there, whether that's media blitzes, getting that out, especially in the pre-fall when we see a lot of that outdoor activity, as well as incorporating it into our firearm safety courses and other programs that we have across the state to educate our hunters and young kids. We would absolutely do that.
Thank you, Colonel Grecki. Lead Fisher.
Thank you.
All right, members. Seeing no further questions, Representative Gilman renews her motion that House File 944, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Congratulations, Representative. Your bill is moving forward. Members, that concludes today's agenda. We are adjourned. Okay.